There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandelin. I'm your host. On today's program, the other NPR, Neighborhood Public Radio, opening the doors of their studio to all comers from a storefront on Manhattan's Upper East Side. I'll be speaking with NPR's Lee Montgomery about this radio experiment that's part of the Whitney Biennial. You do want to stay tuned. If it's in a neighborhood and it makes noise, they hope to put it on the air. Neighborhood Public Radio is an independent, artist-run radio project committed to providing an alternative media platform for artists, activists, musicians, and community members. I had the opportunity to visit Neighborhood Public Radio, which is participating in the Whitney Museum Biennial, taking place in the Upper East Side of Manhattan in New York City. I had a chance to see their storefront studio space with an open door. It says, come on in to anyone who wants to come on by. Lee Montgomery is one of the people behind this project, and he tells us more about what it is.
Well, we're called Neighborhood Public Radio. We started January 2004 at a gallery in Oakland called 21 Grand Gallery. And shortly after that, we did and that was just like a five-day broadcast where we occupied the gallery space and tried to document the psychological neighborhood, if you will. I mean, geography definitely played into it. We used to say, you're listening to Neighborhood Public Radio, broadcasting from 14th Street to MacArthur, between Telegraph and Broadway, which was a little bit of a diminution of our range, but we knew that people could hear us in that range.
So you were actually broadcasting at
yes,
that point?
We were at that point. We had a 6-watt transmitter in the space that was doing the broadcasting. And like I say, it had a very short range of probably less than a mile. And part of that was that we didn't know how to mount the antenna. We were flying by the seat of our pants. But it was really fun because we would have music shows in the evening and interviews and talk and whatever happened would happen during the day, and we found that people would come to see what was going on and listen to it in their car and hear, like, we had an all-day electronic festival on one of the Sundays, and the musicians playing in the festival would show up and play their set and then listen to whoever was next as they were leaving to go to their next gig or whatever, or would hear it as they came in, and that would sort of get them prepared for it. So it really expanded the reach of the event, mm-hmm. In a way that was very interesting, and activated the space. And so from there, I think, another gallery in San Francisco called Southern Exposure Gallery sort of saw the benefit and the community outreach that was inherent in just turning on a transmitter and pointing some microphones at a community. And so we did a 6-week program with them as part of the Way We Work show. And then after that, we did some smaller broadcasts and got a grant from CEC ArtsLink to go and do some broadcasting in Novi Sad, Serbia, where we left some equipment with them, to which they continue to use to broadcast there. We also learned a lot about the very anarchic landscape of media in current Serbia.
Yeah.
and did some broadcasting at the Borderline Festival down in Tarifa, Spain, where we were sort of trying to broadcast into Morocco, more as a symbolic gesture than anything else. Then we came back and we started doing some storefront broadcasts in San Francisco with Artist Television Access. And we kept that going for about 9 months. We broadcast at the end of that, we started broadcasting with the ISEA 01 Festival in San Jose in a ticket booth for a movie theater, basically, which was also right on a promenade where a lot of people would walk through. And it was also part of a technology festival. So there were lots of interesting ways to sort of get this high-minded technology festival to interact with, you know, the homeless shelter that was right around the corner from where the movie theater was.
Maybe tell me a little bit more about what you do when you do a broadcast.
Right. It varies and it has evolved. Initially, it was very much about just reflecting the community of the gallery, and it was very much about that the gallery is frequently an isolated space. People go there to see art, and art is sort of rarefied by many. And so there are a lot of people in the community where art galleries exist that don't actually interact with that art gallery. And I think we saw that in great relief when we went to Chicago for their Version Festival, where we saw a lot of art galleries sort of setting up in depressed neighborhoods. And so there were all of these kids with, you know, MFAs or pursuing MFAs or in school, sort of squatting in these neighborhoods, but not really engaging with the neighborhoods. And we worked in whatever way we could to reach out beyond the typical residents
to the more the residents of the neighborhood.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, hence the neighborhood public radio.
Yeah.
Well, and so how did you reach out? I mean, what was the nature of that engagement?
Well, early on, I mean, like at Southern Exposure, when we were there for 6 weeks, we reached out to the Asian community there. So there's a vibrant Filipino community just a few blocks down in South of Market. So we had women from the Asian Women's Shelter. We had some sort of elders in the community there come and do radio shows. We also worked with the Youth Advisory Board of the gallery to sort of reach out further into the community. And, you know, just found organizations in the immediate area that seemed like they were doing good work and tried to say, what would you do if you had a radio show?
Mm.
So like the Asian Women's Shelter, nothing about what they do is media related, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really about talking to people on a one-on-one basis. But when they were given the opportunity to do a radio show, over the course of the 6 weeks, they really developed some content and really informed people in a way that I don't think anybody coming in from outside of their situation would be able to do. And at the end of the 6 weeks, they were really wishing they could continue doing it. And our point is to say, yes, you can continue doing it. Just you can't do it with us. You have to do it on your own, and hopefully people will.
So where did the idea come from? I mean, to do this and to do it specifically in art galleries, how did that come about? Because, you know, you start out in the Bay Area, and there have been plenty of unlicensed stations over time, some still operating, you know, that have, like Free Radio Berkeley had a very communitarian outlook, you know, to hand back the airways to a neighborhood. What was the genesis of this idea then, of taking it and merging it a bit more with the arts community?
Some of it was happy coincidence, and over time it sort of has made sense. You know, I used to be a volunteer at KALX Berkeley, which is also a community-based station, but felt that even in that relatively free-form environment, there were a lot of restrictions. Mm. I am trained as an artist, but have always been sort of non-traditional in my approaches. And so when I had an opportunity to do radio again, or had an opportunity to work in an art gallery again, I wanted to fuse my interest in radio and my interest in art. And it seemed to make sense for issues of free speech that rise up around the experimentation with transmission technology mm-hmm. to find a home in the free speech environment of an art gallery. And so it started with a little iPod transmitter as part of a group show and evolved into what it's become. And I think what we've developed is a real sense that the aesthetics that we deal with and the activism that we deal with, or the communitarian approach, are indivisible, because one of the things that is going to lead to more interesting, exotic, advanced experimentation with transmission as opposed to just with sound is greater access to transmission equipment. Mm-hmm. And so without, you know, lobbying in some way for greater access to transmission equipment, we can't possibly make the case for a more diverse aesthetic environment.
And what is, can you, I mean, give me a sense of what that aesthetic environment is. You know, you said, you know, like KALX, mm-hmm. which is a freeform station.
Right.
And pretty eclectic, I would argue. You said there were still restrictions.
Yeah.
And which you don't feel or have is so true of neighborhood public radio.
Well, we try and avoid those restrictions. You know, people, you know, ask what words they can and can't say. And we say, you can say any words you can pronounce. it's not a problem. You know, and I do feel like when it comes to making an impassioned point, if you're constantly worried about the $500,000 fine you're going to get for saying fuck, you're not going to be able to be as free in expressing any opinion you might have. And it's not that I think, you know, it necessarily, that there's necessarily value in sort of the gratuitous use of patently offensive language. I'm not, but I also don't think that there should be a situation where there, I don't think it's possible to have a free speech environment where people worry about censoring themselves on that level. And if someone's, you know, natural mode of expression is to say shit and every other word, then they should be allowed to do that freely to get their point across.
Mm-hmm. What other aesthetic, or yeah. shall we say, constraints were there, or are there in just other in conventional licensed radio? Because yeah.
I think it's things that a lot of us have taken for granted, and I think it's something that we have to really work to sort of impress upon people that they don't have to conform to. That they're devices that certainly are useful and should be paid attention to, but that need to be moved again. You know, like that you, when you're doing a typical radio interview, you should stop every, you know, 10 minutes to do a station ID and remind people who they're talking to. Yeah, that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that, but you shouldn't ever feel, I think that can feel like a real restraint to people. When you're having a really engaging conversation. And then, you know, you get into the situation where, say, you're doing a long take in an interview, and then you have to edit it to allow for that 10-minute, you know, every 10 minutes I'm going to, you know, go somewhere else just to remind people what they're listening to. You know, that means that you're going to have to cut something else out. And we don't edit anything that comes on Neighborhood Public Radio. We're just about, you have the time you have to do whatever you want to do. We will sometimes trim the beginning or the end if we know, like, somebody was getting themselves ready and we were just letting a loop run or something like that. But generally speaking, everything that happens is recorded and you hear it, both in the archive and live. Mm-hmm. And there's something very immediate and important about doing it that way. I don't suggest that all radio should necessarily be that way, but name one other venue where radio is that way. And that, to me, that's one of the aesthetics. But also, you know, in one of our more recent projects with the Creative Work Fund and Southern Exposure, we dealt with placement of transmitters. Like, we did the alternate soundtrack city tours where we would place a transmitter and then figure out what the perimeter of it was and lead people on a walk where deliberately they would walk just outside the range of the transmission using the radios that we gave them. And so they'd have to sort of find their way back to where the edge of the transmission was and, you know, would hear audio of things that were obviously no longer there or that drew their attention to things that they might not otherwise have noticed. And really emphasize the ephemeral nature of a radio broadcast in that way. We also had some of these small real estate transmitters in a project called Talking Homes, which were placed in houses so that people could share stories and you'd try and guess what story came from what house. We had the State of Mind Stations projects where people would call into a phone line and then their compiled confessions of their state of mind at any given moment would be played back for the area so that you had a sort of gauge of the community's state of mind. All of these are things that I don't think you would see in traditional media. You certainly wouldn't see them on your local National Public Radio affiliate.
No, it would. And if you did, I mean, you have these little talkback segments or something. But you're right; they're highly edited.
Exactly.
You know, it's not at all just some stream of consciousness. It's been, you know, cut down and made most easily digestible, you know, largely for time and then also content.
Yeah, exactly. And so, we also do workshops where we teach people how to build their own, like, little legal transmitters in the Tetsuo Kagawa model.
Yes.
And, you know, that's all about, like, okay, now you've got that. What are you going to do with it? How are you going to experiment with this thing that will broadcast within a room? And then, you know, like the alternate soundtrack city tours is taking that a step further. What are you going to do with that thing when now suddenly you can broadcast, you know, over several city blocks? How do you play with that? And again, getting back to the aesthetics versus the access, without the access, you can't imagine an aesthetic of a work of art that is about a continuous signal that defines a shape of a path around a city.
Right, because a city has contours, and a radio signal has contours, and a neighborhood has contours.
Right.
Right. So you've got the physical space, the physical manifestation of it, and it's always a little fuzzy on the edges.
Exactly. Always.
Where does the neighborhood begin and end? People can get into fistfights about that one. And
oh, yeah.
The radio signal.
Well, and that was something we deliberately did not explore too deeply in the mission where we were based, doing that project.
In San Francisco, in the mission.
Yeah, in San Francisco's mission on 25th and Mission is where we did the alternate soundtrack city tours. And, you know, there's a dividing line just a few blocks over from there between two gang territories. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a hard line.
Yes.
Our line was very much about a soft, fuzzy, enveloping area. And it probably, crossed over gang territories. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, because you can't see it. There's no red and blue. There's simply, you know, what can you do with your radio? You know, so there's, you know, and it's a more truly interactive kind of medium too, because of the unexpected nature of it. When you're walking around with your radio, you don't know how strong the reception is on your radio versus how strong the signal is on the transmitter. And somewhere by walking around, you interact with this, you know, detritus in the air that is very exciting. I will never forget when I was much younger in junior high and high school, when there were more startup radio stations and you would, you know, get your radio out. And I remember WHFS broadcasting out of Annapolis was playing, you know, independent music at that time that you could not hear anywhere else, or WCVT out of Towson State University when I was growing up. And they had these very low signals, and you'd have to sort of move around your room and try and position your radio just right to get it. But it was absolutely worth it because you'd hear something that you couldn't hear otherwise.
So let's talk a little bit here. I mean, we're here on Madison Avenue.
Yes, we are.
In the heart of Manhattan, right next door to the Whitney Museum of Art.
Yes.
It's part of their biennial. And so Neighborhood Public Radio is participating.
Yes.
As part of that.
Yes.
Why don't you tell me a little bit more about what's going on and how that came about and what you're doing?
Sure. I don't know. Who was it? I forget. Mike Lupica from WFMU came to a show early on in our run here. And
WFMU is a really great freeform station just over the river in Jersey City.
Yes. Where we've worked with them a little bit. DJ Billy Jam over there has done some shows with us. And we went over there for an interview at one point. But before all that, Mike Lupica had written, I hope I'm saying his name right, had written about a show by the Enablers that he'd come to see during our first weeks. And he referred to our presence in the Whitney Biennial as being by some strange twist of fate. And I'm going to say that that's probably true. I the curators could give you a better sense of why they wanted us, but somehow they found us. They liked what they heard when they talked to us. We negotiated a bit about how we would exactly participate. They said they had a storefront for us. Here we are. what are we doing? Well, we were hoping to do a little bit more workshop type stuff, like showing people how to build transmitters and experiment with them. But when we set up two microphones and a CD player and a mixer in the window of a storefront on Madison Avenue, we found people were coming in at a furious pace, and before we knew it, we had more people coming in to do shows than we knew what to do with.
Wow.
And so we've pretty much had a full schedule from 11 to 6 every day, or 1 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Fridays. Monday and Tuesday we take the day off, because
you're tired.
Even we need a weekend. And yeah, I mean, it's been a constant flow of people coming in and out of here.
And I mean, is this a little different kind of neighborhood than where you've generally set up in Oakland or the Mission?
It's a very different neighborhood than what we usually have setting up, and we had some reservations about that. And based on what I think probably many people who are listening right now might be thinking is like, we had a guy come in just a few minutes ago, and I gave him the spiel as to what we do, and he said, "Oh, so while you're here, you're just listening to the rich people," and. And the fact of the matter is, we worried that that might be the case. And we have had, a retired couple, Aaron Schechter and Elaine Abrams, come in early on. And he used to be the accountant for The Who, The Rolling Stones, a bunch of other people. We've had Mick Jagger, Samuel L. Jackson, and others walk past the window. All that's here.
Yeah.
That is the environment. But we've also had Bernard, the guy who cleans the space for us, do a show. Okay. We've had Carlos and Delano, who work in security and facilities, respectively, here, do a show. We have had various people who are caregivers, like take care of people's children and the like. We have had all sorts of people who come up here who have just decided that, they want to do a radio show, from Brooklyn, from Queens, from out of town. So it hasn't been as, we've had the security guards who from the Madison Improvement District, Madison Avenue Business Improvement District, come in and do shows. And we had a guy named, I was just listening to him earlier, Leonard Margolis, who did a whistling show, who basically lives in a tenement on the 80s around 3rd Avenue.
Okay.
And can barely afford his rent. When he left here, he was looking for bottles to, fill out his budget because he's on a fixed income, and basically, was run out of his apartment and now has to pay like four times what he was paying originally. So, a lot of that is kept undercover. You don't see
right.
when you come up here. But the fact of the matter is, There are doormen, there are dog walkers, there are people who work in the various shops who have a lot to contribute to the neighborhood and who are in the neighborhood every day. And honestly, they're the ones who've been on the air more than, you know, the people in the upper income range.
And, I mean, what's their reaction, generally speaking? I mean, how are they?
I generally try to be a fairly modest person. But it would be false modesty for me to say that we have received anything but effusive praise from almost everybody that's come in.
Well, they're not. They don't expect it.
They do not expect it. I mean, we have had some people who think that we're a blight on the neighborhood. Like one or two people who've been like, you know, what are you doing in my neighborhood? This used to be a respectable business, and now look at it. But by and large, we've had people, some who've come for the biennial, some who had no idea there was any such thing as a biennial, who have consistently told us that this is either the best thing that's happened on Madison Avenue in a long time or the best thing in the biennial, or, you know, I have been really stunned by the effusive praise that we've gotten from pretty much everybody that's come in who didn't work for National Public Radio.
That was part one of an interview with Lee Montgomery from Neighborhood Public Radio. Next week, we'll hear more, including a little bit about Neighborhood Public Radio's run-in with National Public Radio. And you can tune in on the web to Neighborhood Public Radio's live web stream right now at neighborhoodpublicradio.org. And they are at the Whitney Biennial in New York City through the end of May. So you've got a little bit of time left to go check them out. And then next week we'll hear more about their future plans. Before we close out the show here, I wanted to do a little bit of news. A few weeks ago, I reported on the Senate Commerce Committee passing a resolution of disapproval on the FCC's December decision, all but eliminating the newspaper TV cross-ownership ban. Well, on May 15th, this resolution passed the full Senate. It passed on a voice vote, but it had the sponsorship of Senator Byron Dorgan and 24 other senators. That's a fair number of sponsors. A parallel version of this bill is yet to be introduced in the House, but there seems to be pretty broad support for it. And if it's passed, it would go on to President Bush, who has promised to veto it. But nevertheless, it does show some degree of strong support in the Senate for seeing the cross-ownership ban preserved in a much stronger fashion than it currently exists. And that then brings us to a close of this edition of Media Geek. I will be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. Of course, well, the second part of that interview with Lee Montgomery from Neighborhood Public Radio. In the meantime, of course, you can check out Media Geek online. The Media Geek blog is at MediaGeek.net, and the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. You can listen in your browser, or you can download the MP3, or you can subscribe to the podcast to get it automatically. All of that is there at MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@MediaGeek.net. I do love to hear from you. If you have anything at all to make the show a little bit better, I'll do what I can. But of course, thank you for tuning in.